Hi, everyone, and welcome to a very special episode of
Ocean Science Radio.
Today, we are trying a slightly different format. For this episode, my stellar shark scientist co-host Vicky Vasquez and I are joined by a panel of scientists to discuss the most recent report by
the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC.
We're going to take a deep dive into this report, how it came about, what it actually says, and
where we go from here.
With us, we have John Bruno.
Hey, Andrew and Vicky. Yeah, I'm John Bruno. I'm a professor at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm a marine ecologist, and I study the impacts of ocean heating on marine ecosystems.
And next, we have Tessa Hill.
Hey there. Thanks for hosting this conversation. I am a professor at University of California, Davis, and I'm based at Bodega Marine Lab on the Northern California coast, where I do work on climate change impacts on marine systems.
Go Aggies. And next, we have George H. Leonard.
Hi, Andrew. Hi, Vicky. Thanks for having me today. I am chief scientist at Ocean Conservancy. We are an international ocean conservation organization. I work on the interface of science and policy, trying to take new insights like from this new report and turn them into policy action and advocacy campaigns to make the ocean a better place.
And as a fellow Aggie and former student at Bodega Bay Marine Labs, I'm super stoked that we have one more person from that area, PhD student Priya Shukla, also from UC Davis.
Hey, Vicky and Andrew. Thanks for having me. I am a PhD student at UC Davis, just as Vicky said, and I'm also a contributor for Forbes Science, where I write about ocean science and climate change. And at UC Davis, I study the effects of warming on the seafood that we grow here in California.
All right. So thanks for the introductions. To start off, let's get a little background. George, what is the IPCC and what does it do?
So the IPCC, as indicated earlier, is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and it was established in 1988 to really bring science and technical information specifically on climate change into the larger kind of ongoing question and conversation around what are we going to do about this problem. It's designed to draw on the scientific expertise of scientists all around the world. It involves sort of three separate working groups. There's one that focuses on the physical science of climate change, another on the impact on nature and people, and then the working group three focuses on methods for mitigation and adaptation. They typically, about every 5 years or so, put together a summary report on the status of climate change science. And this has been going on since the late 80s. We are now in the sixth assessment period, which is undergoing review right now. Those three working groups are engaged in their synthesis. There are also three special reports for the first time that are being developed as part of this process. And we're here to talk about the Ocean and Cryosphere report today, but it's worth recognizing that there was also a report that came out comparing 1.5 degrees with 2 degrees future and what that means for the globe. There was also a special report on climate change impacts on land, and this third special report is on climate impacts in the ocean. At the end of about 2022 or so, there will be a big synthesis report that integrates all of the special reports as well as the ongoing working groups from the ongoing assessment.
George, I have a question about the working groups. How are the members selected?
So the members are selected. They are sort of nominated from within the different countries and the different contingents. And then there's essentially a vetting process to make sure that there aren't any, you know, conflict of interest or any of those kinds of problems.
Okay, great. Thanks.
So that is a lot of reporting with a lot of different points of entry. John, can you talk a little bit about what specifically was covered in this SROC?
This report covered all the knowledge we have really across humanity about how climate change is impacting the oceans and the cryosphere. And the cryosphere is essentially all the ice on Earth, including sea ice and ice at the poles on the land. And that might seem like a weird linkage, but there's a really important mechanistic kind of link between melting of land ice and the ocean. The biggest one, obviously, is sea level rise. So a large proportion of the rise of sea level along our coast is due to the melting of land ice in the Arctic and in glaciers that kind of runs off into the ocean and increases the volume of the oceans.
And you actually live tweeted your reading of it, right?
I did. I got up at 3 in the morning, and as soon as it was available, downloaded it, and skimmed it and kind of like live tweeted, you know, impressions, tried to translate some of the science. It's a very technical document to people. And of course, I didn't read the whole thing. It's over 1,000 pages, single space. You know, I still haven't read the whole thing. I'm sure nobody will ever read the whole thing. But I mean, it's a really impressive document and how much science there is in it. I mean, it's really exciting to folks like us to just see all that science. None of it was really, you know, surprising to us because this is our field. Like, you know, we contributed a lot of the science to it. So like we're aware of stuff coming out. But it's really fun to read about thawing in the Arctic and how that's affecting vegetation, you know, things that are way outside my area of specialty.
Well, it's very impressive that you started reading that at 3 a.m. Definitely shows dedication.
Yeah, I totally wouldn't do that.
I got roped into it.
Priya, you had some more insights into it that you wanted to talk about. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the nitty-gritty details that this report really covered?
Yeah, John sort of touched on this really important aspect of the report about how the cryosphere and the oceans are connected, which I think is something that a lot of people don't necessarily think about, especially if you don't interact with either of those systems on a regular basis or just one of them. So just as John said, basically, when we have these glaciers or sea ice masses melting into the ocean, you get sea level rise. And so there are a couple of really interesting things that are coming out of that that are worth discussing holistically. So one of those things is the fact that as we are seeing sea level rise encroach along our coasts and glaciers and sea ice masses basically disappearing, that means that for islands or for coastal zones or for the Arctic and Antarctic ice sheets, the animals and plants that live on there, their habitat is shrinking. But at the same time, as this water is melting, we're seeing a change in the local area where the water is melting. So it's causing some physical changes in the seawater. And I think John is going to touch on some of that a little bit later. But what that also means is that you're creating new habitat. And so species that are actually trying to get out of areas that are warming, they are finding new habitat in these colder areas. And that's something that we don't know a lot about, but it's something that has definitely been documented. And I'm talking right now about the plant and animal communities. But of course, the other part of this that is really worth discussing is the fact that there are human communities that are also affected. The ocean, of course, is 70% of our planet, and ice sort of covers the other 10%, and that includes not only the coastal zone, but high mountain regions. And there are vulnerable populations in the high mountains, but also along zones of sea level rise and in the polar regions. And in fact, I think 10% of people that live along the Arctic zone are in fact indigenous. And so they also have really strong cultural ties. So sea ice loss for them is more than just water melting into the ocean. It's a loss of their cultural heritage.
Now, in terms of like flora and fauna, when people think about polars getting warm, we always talk about polar bears, but could you kind of mention some of the other animals that are affected that people may not realize?
One of the key things that folks that study the Antarctic are looking at right now are krill, because as the waters are warming in the Antarctic, we're actually seeing a decline in krill, which are basically like shrimp, and they form the base of the food web down there. So a lot of mammals, including seals and whales that visit the Antarctic, are basically losing a primary food source for them. Something that we might not think is that important and actually a little bit ugly, but is in fact really critical to the animals down there.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because that takes me back to an interesting memory of watching a blue whale poop in the Monterey Bay. What? And so I'm guessing that that all that red stuff was krill.
Yes. I mean, I can't guarantee because I wasn't there, but I would assume so. Cool.
I can talk about that because in another podcast that I'm on with a bunch of ocean scientists, it turns out that whale poop, especially, I forget if it's baleen whales or what, but they have higher concentrations of iron in their poop than anywhere in the ocean. And a lot of that red actually comes from, or that red orange comes from iron.
That's really cool.
Whoa. We could go into like a whole side thing on that, but
yeah, let's not dive into
Moss Landing is known for doing the iron experiments and figuring a little bit about that connection with limiting nutrients. And then the other fun or not so fun thing is, I believe the role that whales play is so important that as whaling was occurring, you can actually see a change in like the atmosphere. And then as we put more laws in to protect the whales, you could see that it improved again. So very weird.
That's one of the issues of getting in a room full of a bunch of ocean nerds. We talk ad nauseum about all sorts of different topics and ping pong everywhere. So getting back on topic. All right. So we have this report coming out, and this report goes over all sorts of different aspects. But to really understand it from a lay perspective, what should I know about how it's framed? What are some of the basic things that the public really should know before approaching this report?
Well, so George here, I wanted to kind of pose a question out to some of the other folks on the phone, too. I think a number of us have been sort of studying and doing research in oceans for quite some time now. And for me, one of the real take-home messages from this SROC report was the fact that the scale and the pace of climate change in the ocean isn't just changing, but it's actually accelerating. So this is true for sea level rise, where the rates of change in the last decade are, you know, double what they were just 10 years ago. My sense is from the temperature records that the ocean continues to heat and the predictions are pretty dire. And Tessa, from your area of expertise on ocean acidification, you know, that continues kind of a downward spiral. And I was just wondering what people's thoughts were on whether these rates aren't just changing, but they're actually accelerating, and what that means for kind of the oceans of today as well as tomorrow.
I agree, George. I'm pretty sure that's the case. Like, I'm a little uncomfortable saying it only because it's been only, like you said, a 10 years, and you know, the 10 years prior, warming was decelerating. I don't know, I just worry a little bit about making too much of it. But I agree, like looking at the recent data, it certainly looks like there's been an acceleration. We've been using the satellite hotspot database, looking at the Caribbean, and there absolutely has been an acceleration in like the magnitude and duration of hotspots. I mean, I think we should say it. I don't know. What do you think, Tessa?
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think it seems like the rate of change and the scale of change has been surprising to the scientific community more broadly, even just beyond this report. I think some of that is that we're starting to really see the effects. And so we're not just seeing it in data, but we're starting to see it sort of in our own backyards. And so that sort of drives it home a little further. I think sort of adding to that in terms of major strengths of this report is that the report is structured around two trajectories that we could be on. And one of those trajectories sort of represents a scenario where emissions peak by 2020. And the other one is sort of a worst case scenario. And I think it's actually really powerful that the report is framed around these two scenarios, because it basically sets up the idea that we choose where we land on these scenarios. And the reality is that we'll probably land somewhere in between those two scenarios that are plotted in the report. But we make choices that determine our trajectory on these sort of modeled outcomes. And I'm curious if the rest of you found sort of the use of those scenarios interesting or compelling.
I agree completely, Tessa. That's one of my favorite things about the report. It really shows us we have agency. We have a choice to make. And it's between a bad outcome and a really, really, really bad outcome. So, right. I mean, it's obvious which one we want to choose. But yeah.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. And I think the other thing that the report did for me in terms of comparing those sort of two trajectories is, you know, there's been a bit of a false narrative, I think, out there between this question around mitigation and adaptation. And for a long time, it was like, we can't talk about adaptation because we really just need to focus on getting our carbon emissions down. And adaptation is a distraction. And I think what the report makes clear is that if we're on that worst case scenario where we don't mitigate, then adaptation actually can't help us. There's just not enough adaptation we can do to that. But if we can get ourselves on a low emissions trajectory, then adaptation kind of across the full suite of actions that we can take in the ocean makes a really, really big difference. And so it suggests to me that our narrative needs to be, we need to mitigate and adapt simultaneously. It's not an either or choice.
I totally agree.
I would just add to this discussion is that what I found really compelling about this report is that this is the first time that governments requested that the scientists extend the modeling beyond the year 2100. And I think that sort of illustrates the extent to which we think we'll be seeing some of these impacts. I think thinking about how governments are thinking about using this information in protecting the resources for the future of their communities and countries is also really interesting and really valuable.
And can you remind us, you said the projections have gone further than they have before. So
yeah, but time-wise, I forget the exact year, so I don't have the figures in front of me, but
yeah, typically IPCC only projects out to 2100 And for some of the characteristics, it went out to 2300. Sea level rise is the really important one, because sea level rise continues. You know, 1 meter by 2100 sounds really bad, but yeah, we can probably cope with that. But under the worst case scenario, you know, sea level rise out at 2300 could be upwards of like 15 to 17 feet. And I mean, that's just really hard to get your head around. So, but right, that's what we're looking at. And I do think it's important that we're looking a little farther into the future now.
So how do we all feel about uncertainty when we get that far out there, particularly around sea level rise? Because of course, one of the big uncertainties is the stability of the ice sheets and whether there's sort of catastrophic failure out around those timelines. And just, I mean, I'm trying to think about this from sort of a policy and a communications perspective, where uncertainty is sometimes used as an excuse for inaction.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what you think about it as the opposite, that is, as a motivator for action.
I'll just say, from my perspective as someone who does some work with paleoclimate, that what we know from the geologic record is those predictions that Priya and John just pointed out in terms of the magnitudes of sea level rise are totally reasonable based upon what we see from past warming events. And so, yes, there is probably uncertainty around those estimates, but are they out of the ballpark in terms of what we understand about the Earth system? No.
Yeah, if anything, they're an underestimate. You know, during the last interglacial, what was it, Tessa? 1.5 degrees C warmer, and sea level rise was about 18 feet higher than it is now. You know, we see evidence of that all around the world with coral reefs that are now stranded out of the water.
That's right.
So right.
I think it's sort of the kind of decisions that we should think about making. Like, if we think the worst case scenario is an 18-foot increase in sea level, does that mean we build a 20-foot seawall? Or do we instead divert those resources into maybe securing mangroves that could help stave some of that off? While there is uncertainty, it's thinking about what is the best solution for maybe dealing with some of that uncertainty, if that makes sense.
One thing that I would really like to get clarified is the best case scenario here. We're talking about emissions peaking at a certain time. So what does that actually indicate from a on the ground perspective? Like, what does that mean that humanity has to achieve by that date?
Well, we're clearly in an all hands on deck moment, right? I mean, Greta Thunberg and the protests, I mean, I think they've all got it right, that this isn't just changing out a few light bulbs in your house. It's a fundamental rethinking of our energy future. And that is a tall order, right? I mean, the only time that we've mobilized as a global community at that level has been basically during the two world wars. So, you know, how we get there, particularly in the U.S., given the current political dynamic, is another issue. But the other side of that is not only reducing emissions at that scale, but it's also increasing sequestration and perhaps drawing carbon out of the atmosphere. And this is where I think, you know, biological systems like blue carbon habitats in coastal communities can play a big role in terms of contributing to that overall drawdown effect. And I think this also, if we stare this down, forces us to have a pretty clear-eyed discussion around geoengineering and some of these other more extremist interventions that are now being discussed in the face of not declining emissions, but actually increases in emissions.
Yes, I would say all that geoengineering could be like a whole nother podcast, but just learning a little bit about it from one of my professors at Moss Landing Marine Labs, Dr. Kenneth Cole, he was telling us how he contributed to this iron experiment. And what them as scientists weren't expecting was that venture capitalists, I guess, kind of took that idea and were trying to put it on a bigger scale. You know, today we're talking about climate change, but you all are experts in different parts of this field. So when you're working on something else, do you notice the same thing of something getting politicized or misinterpreted as often as it does when the word climate change comes up? So like if you're studying animals or just the plankton, somebody get mad about plankton?
I would say that, so I work with aquaculture, and I think aquaculture means a lot of different things to a lot of people. And so an analogy there is that it really depends on the context within which you're operating. You want to know who you're speaking with and what their values are and what your values are, and making sure that you can have a conversation that sort of is around those shared values, if that makes sense. But I do think that especially as the situation around us gets more dire, we will see probably both a lot of politicizing, even further politicizing of climate change, maybe also collapsing some of those barriers in an effort to find solutions. And this has been done in the past. There are many examples. I think the one that springs to mind for me is acid rain and also the ozone problems that we've had, where basically global governance systems as well as the manufacturers have come together to resolve some of these problems. So we can all make decisions every day, but there also needs to be some decision making that happens by the powers that be.
Just to go steer things a little bit back to the report, because there were many different subjects that this report really touched on, and we've kind of hit on like a little bit of sea level rise and a little bit of mitigation. But one thing that I really wanted to like dive into, and I keep using that just because we're an ocean podcast, is heat. Like one of the main takeaways from the report, at least from what I got from the summary, is that things have been getting hotter and just projecting to get more and more hot. John, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the report's really sobering in terms of ocean heating. About 94% of the additional heat being retained in the Earth due to greenhouse gases is going into the ocean. And essentially all of the ocean is heating, including the deepest parts of the ocean, which is really incredible to think about. There also seems to be some sense of acceleration in the rate of heating in the upper ocean, the surface waters. And the projections for continued heating are really dire. So we're looking at 3.5, 4 degrees Celsius warming under the worst case scenario by the end of the century in most of the ocean. So that's the average warming rate. In some parts, we'll be seeing 5, 8, 9 degrees Celsius. You know, that's incredible. Mostly the Arctic, some parts of the northwestern Atlantic. And that heating is just having all kinds of disruptive effects on the way ocean ecosystems function, on the way food webs are structured. And those aren't projections. Those are things that have already happened. I mean, some of these things are past tense, you know, over the last 20 years. So it's really remarkable just the breadth of processes and kind of static characteristics that heating is changing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, John, you work in these systems now in the field. I don't. I'm working in the policy space at this point, but I was pretty stunned that in terms of things like acidity and oxygen and temperature, that these things aren't just affecting the surface waters, but are, you know, all the way down thousands of meters below the surface. You know, it's a huge planet. It's a lot of water. It's pretty astounding that the scientific community and the instruments and the modeling now can actually detect climate effects in the ocean pretty much everywhere.
George, I was just thinking before we started this, did you imagine 25 years ago when we were sharing an office at Brown as graduate students that we'd see this magnitude of change in the oceans due to climate change? I mean, we weren't even really talking about climate change in 1995, 1996. I don't think I was aware of it until 97, 98. Like, what do you think about
that? No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I was having this conversation just the other day where it was like, you know, you and I were studying what we thought were essentially relatively pristine habitat. And it was just on the cusp of changing biophysics. It was just on the cusp of species starting to move in the Gulf of Maine, like the green crab and lobsters. This was all right at the beginning of that. And it is amazing. I mean, when I think about how the world can learn from scientists, I think they obviously can learn from data and facts and graphs, but I think people are really motivated by stories, and I think it's the personal stories of what folks like you and Tessa and Priya and others have experienced over the course of their professional careers. You know, they are barometers of what's happening out there, and we're all old enough and yet still alive enough to be able to tell some pretty amazing stories about how climate change isn't something that happens over generations. It's happening in our lifetimes.
You know, I think that's a good segue into Priya, since she writes quite a few articles for Forbes, which I think is super awesome.
Awesome.
I hope you put that everywhere in your house, on your fridge. It's just so cool.
I should start pinning those to my fridge.
Yes. So, you know, some of it, you've talked about ocean heat waves and you've written about ocean diseases. And I thought it'd be cool if you could talk about if there's any connection between like ocean viruses and increasingly hot oceans.
Yeah, so there's definitely a connection between increases in seawater temperature and diseases. But I want to start off by saying that diseases in the ocean are normal. And in fact, they're a good thing in the same way that, say, sea otters regulate the urchin populations in a kelp forest. Diseases also can help basically control populations in the ocean. But what we're seeing now is that as you ramp up temperatures in the ocean, we're seeing an increase in the amount of diseases that are happening. For example, along the Pacific coast in 2013, there was this massive outbreak of sea star wasting disease, and a paper that came out earlier this year from Drew Harvell's lab shows that those are really strongly correlated to increases in seawater temperature. Very similarly, in 2014, there was this new disease that was discovered in Caribbean corals called stony coral tissue loss disease, which is actually really funnily called Skittle D. But the disease itself is not so funny. It's led to very severe losses in corals. Now, in the system that I'm studying, and I specifically work with farmed oysters, and we're looking at basically an oyster killing virus that when you see temperature go above 61 degrees Fahrenheit, you could lose 80% of the oysters when they're really young. So that's a really huge impact, and trying to understand the relationship between temperature and disease is important because it's really wiping out so many species. And a paper that actually came out last week that is not related to the SROC, but is in fact a huge review of disease literature that's been done since 1970, shows that we've seen an increase in diseases that have happened in urchins, but actually a decrease in diseases that have happened in fish, but not because we've done anything good. It's actually that we're less able to document those diseases because of overfishing.
Wow. Yeah. Depressing on top of depressing.
Yeah. And that paper was by Priya, Allison Tracy, by the way. I should mention that.
Yep. So Priya, question for you then. Is what's happening in the ocean relative to disease and climate change kind of analogous to what's happening on land with respect to disease? I'm just wondering whether basically we're seeing the same kinds of mechanisms and disease incidents and lethality in the ocean that we are on land. I'm always curious about whether basically the same things are happening in both parts of the world, but obviously the species and the details are different.
That's a great question, and I'm definitely better versed in ocean diseases at this point, but we do know that there is an increase in disease transmission on land as well, and that includes not just obviously the plants and animals, but with us too. And so I don't know where the similarities start and end, but I do think that as we continue to see rises in temperature, we will see increases in disease outbreaks. And I think part of that will also be because there will be less habitable areas for humans and animals and plants alike. And so as we all live within closer proximity to one another, there will just be an increase in like pathogenicity and virulence of all these things.
There's actually an interesting paper about that called The Rise and Fall of Infectious Disease in a Warmer World. But that was from like 2016, finding that certain diseases increase and certain diseases will decrease, but overall it's not a good trend.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add in with another plug for good literature on this, which is Drew Harvell's new book, Ocean Outbreak, is really an excellent resource. And it tells the story of several of these disease outbreaks, but perhaps even more importantly, it sort of paints this picture of how the scientific community is sort of racing to catch up with what is happening, because the pace of change and the pace of outbreaks is so fast that it's challenging sort of our ability in the scientific community to keep up, which goes back to some topics that were brought up earlier.
Well, and maybe a little bit of a segue there back to some of the predictions and insights coming from the SROC report. Temperature in particular is impacting fish, and fish are generally seeking cooler water, which is generally toward the poles or toward deeper water, and is putting a lot of pressure on fishing communities and fishing industries and fishery managers to keep up with that, because the whole system of fishery management is not really predicated on variability, and it's based on some level of stability and some level of geographic predictability. And so climate change is likewise causing challenges for our fishing communities as well.
Not just heat, but even acidification, which we've already kind of touched on, and deoxygenation are huge stressors on fishery populations, right?
And Andrew's super stoked to ask you guys about deoxygenation, so just to warn you.
I'm waiting for this for a long time. We literally have an episode in the pocket that I'm editing currently all about deoxygenation with Dr. Mandy Joy and some other people talking about this. And it is the most terrifying thing to me because according to Dr. Joy, deoxygenation can lead to a climate feedback loop, if we're using that term, with like methane emissions and stuff like that. I find that terrifying.
I just want to stop for a second so we can all recognize that someone named Dr. Joy terrified Andrew with facts. Anyways, let's move on.
So, John, with all the work that you've done on corals with respect to temperature effects, what are you seeing impacts on deoxygenation on corals as well? Like, how much is this a multiple stressor problem in tropical systems, or is it really all about heat?
I think in terms of corals, it's 100% about heat. I don't think we're seeing any evidence of additive stressor effects. I mean, a lot of people argue for them, and maybe on like the extreme fringes. But that said, I am also very, very worried about deoxygenation, more from the perspective of fishes in tropical seas. Mm. I mean, you know, you don't have to warm a tropical ocean much where there's just not enough oxygen for fishes to swim fast or to exist in high densities, especially in kind of a shallow back reef environment. So I agree. I think it's a really scary future threat.
I'll just add in that I think that that multi-stressor piece is one of the best parts of how this report is done. And, you know, in looking through and thinking about how the report handled the topics of ocean acidification and deoxygenation, those chemical changes in the ocean are basically handled together with temperature. And that's exactly how we should be thinking about them, because that's what organisms are experiencing, is changes in all of these parameters all at the same time. And the report does a great job of pointing out places where those parameters might kind of pile on top of each other to make things very stressful for organisms. But then in some cases where they don't add up, they actually might, you know, counteract each other. And so interesting thinking about some of the complexities of those chemical changes. And the report does a nice job of handling sort of each ecosystem in terms of these threats. I was meeting with students about this recently, about the report, and we talked about how really any system that they're working in, they could look up and see a really excellent literature review of how that multiple stressor landscape is going to affect their ecosystem using this report.
Yeah, I would second that, Tessa. And in particular, the summary for policymakers, which is itself, you know, 50 or 60 pages long, is a really nice summary of this report. And it includes a number of graphics that are just chocked full of information. So if people who are listening to the podcast are looking for kind of a summary, like across ecosystems and across drivers and across solutions, there's some really nice graphics in that summary for policymakers.
Another thing I would just add in really quickly is that the report discusses the timing of emergence of these different stressors. And so that's sort of thinking about how the signal of climate change is going to get large enough that it will emerge or be seen, you know, separate from natural variability. And the report points out that the first parameters that will sort of emerge are temperature and acidification in most systems, and then followed by these deoxygenation changes and then broader changes in sort of the productivity and abundance and location of species. So it's interesting thinking about this sort of, it's a domino effect of processes, but we're not actually going to see the effects of all the processes all at once.
So on that same thought, from people who are not actively working in fisheries, people who are not studying this scientifically or reading about it constantly, what does this mean to the average person? How, with this emergence, like, are we going to be seeing certain trends more in our food? Or are we going to be seeing more trends in our economy? Like, the person who doesn't really interact with the ocean much on a day-to-day basis, how does this translate to them?
Well, in terms of fisheries productivity, there's winners and losers at the national scale. And generally, the winners are in the higher latitude countries where fisheries production could increase or at least decrease much less. Whereas in most tropical countries, they're going to see very substantial reductions in fisheries production. And we've already talked about three of those drivers: disease, rain shifts that George mentioned, and deoxygenation. But there's several others. Warming itself increases the metabolism of fishes. Most fishes are cold-blooded, so their body temperature matches that of the water around them. So warming means faster metabolisms, and that ultimately leads to lower biomass, lower productivity. Stratification in the oceans, which is primarily caused by freshwater runoff, that freshwater or less salty water kind of floats on the surface of the more salty water down below, and that inhibits the transfer of nutrients from deeper water up to the shallows, and that is causing a well-documented decrease in primary production. So, you know, food sources for fishes, less plant material, plants are growing slower, and that is also going to have a compounding effect on fisheries productivity. So in terms of fisheries output, you know, there's six or seven drivers that all really point to decreased production. In some places, it's projected expected to be up to 30-40% declines. And that's an incredible statistic when you think the Earth's population is growing at a rapid rate and those people need protein in their diets.
Yep. Yep. The other thing to factor here in terms of impacts on people is that all people are not going to be impacted by changes in oceans equally. And this brings up the issue of sort of equity and diversity and, you know, historically disadvantaged communities. Frankly, rich people are going to be able to avoid the impacts of climate change writ large for a much longer time than folks that have lower means. And so as we think about advancing solutions informed by the latest science, we really need to take into consideration the communities that are most vulnerable, that are going to be the communities that are hit the hardest and hit the quickest and have the least ability to deal with the changes that are coming.
This conversation has been very interesting and we've been getting really in depth, but now we're going to take an opportunity to have a little bit of a commercial. So enjoy the small break and we'll be back to the show in a second.
Do you enjoy our podcast? Do you want to help make sure that our podcast continues to bring you the latest, greatest, and sometimes deepest stories from the ocean, and even become greater? Well, you can join our community of sponsors through our Patreon. Give whatever you can, because every bit helps. Help us continue to bring you stories of anthropomorphic underwater robots, the sex life of shellfish, and hard-hitting conversations like the one you're listening to today. Make your contribution now. And remember, different levels get different rewards, so check out all of our tiers and options. Now, back to the show.
I would love to talk about the deep sea.
Yes, I want to hear more. You know, my lab, we work a lot in the deep sea and people always ask us questions about, you know, how is climate change affecting the deep sea? And our answer has always been that you don't see changes there because it's basically the same environment all year long. It's on the coast where animals are dealing with different seasons and whatnot. But is that still the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting question. I was glad that George brought this up earlier as well. I think oftentimes, I also do work in both shallow and deep systems, and oftentimes when I open up a report like this, I sort of expect that they won't say much about the deep sea, sort of because of the, you know, the reason you just gave that people haven't been expecting, perhaps, that it would be deeply affected, pardon the pun. However, I mean, those of us who work a lot in the deep sea know exactly what this report says, which is that the deep sea is exposed to multiple different climate hazards, including warming as well as deoxygenation, you know, the sort of the expanding zones of the ocean with very little oxygen in them are definitely influencing the deep sea, as well as acidification. And the report does a nice job of highlighting another way that the deep sea is connected to these changes, which is that many deep sea systems, not all, not like the hydrothermal vents that you're thinking of, but other deep sea systems are actually dependent upon carbon flux from the surface ocean as a food source. And so I always tell people anything that happens in the surface ocean affects the deep sea because that's where the food is going.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. So when you think about deep sea coral communities or communities, you know, structured by big giant sponges or things like that, they're feeding off of carbon that is literally floating down from the surface ocean. And the report points out that a lot of the existing models where scientists predict impacts on the deep sea don't really incorporate this reliance on surface-derived food. And so the deep sea may actually be affected even more than we think. And the report also points out that deep sea corals are likely to be more affected than, say, sponges, because corals are likely to be impacted by ocean acidification in addition to like temperature, oxygen, and food changes. So some systems may be more at risk than others.
Wow. One thing that I noticed in the report or didn't quite notice in the report was talking about albedo. And if we're talking about, you know, the cryosphere, we're also talking about reflected energy. And if we lose that ice as the ocean heats, then it's going to be not able to reflect the same amount of light since it's shifting from more white to more blue and green. So there seems to be a lot more science that needs to be done, and there's a lot more that we can be adding into this understanding. At this point, since we've already talked quite a bit about what the report covers, I was kind of hoping that we could shift into a bit more of what do we do with this information? Where do we go from here? George, since you have the most experience directly relating science to legislation and policy and action, I was wondering if you could kind of kickstart this conversation.
Sure. So at Ocean Conservancy, we like to focus on solutions to environmental problems, including climate solutions. And I think there is a danger that this SROC report, which is a serious gut punch, given how it explains in excruciating detail what's happening in the ocean, that it can really disempower people and feel like there's really nothing we can do about this. And as a result, I think it's important for us to recognize that there are a range of actions that we can and indeed, you know, we must take. It's probably useful to bucket those a little bit. One is, you know, one bucket of actions are in the mitigation space, and I think that this report has big implications for global ambition in terms of how quickly we get off fossil fuels as a primary energy source and what are the ocean consequences of that. The other is the bucket of adaptation measures. So even if we stopped all emissions today, because of climate inertia, there will be a number of changes, including sea level rise and change in many of these fundamental biophysical drivers that we talked about, that we need to be prepared for and we need to accommodate. And so there's a suite of actions we can talk about there. And then there is policy and political leadership. As we know here in the U.S., this is certainly not true around the world, but certainly in the U.S., we still have a very big sort of climate denier movement. And we need to think about how our elected officials can recognize the severity of climate change and advance solutions here at home. I think many of us are in the U.S. But at the international stage, the Conference of Parties is meeting in Chile in December, and there's a real opportunity there to bring oceans into the international climate change discussions in a way that can be really impactful. So I think there's a range of solutions and a range of ways to talk about them.
Another thing that I was curious about, and I'll direct this towards Priya, is aquacultures. I know that aquaculture has tons of plus and minuses, but as we are moving into the future, is this something that we will rely on more? Is it a good idea, bad? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a really complicated question. And I think John did a really good job of describing how fisheries will be impacted by climate change. Aquaculture is going to suffer a lot of those same consequences when it comes to the poles being more productive, but also if you're for fish at least, but when it comes to things like bivalves, oysters or mussels that are affected by changes in acidity or nutrient levels, they will actually be more negatively impacted. But the power that we have with aquaculture is that we are the ones pulling the levers. We make those decisions. So how we choose to farm seafood is a really important and empowering place to be. And I think that if we're really thoughtful about this, then it can be useful. But there is so much unknown about this. We've done a lot of research on the environmental consequences of aquaculture, and related to something that George said, it's not going to be the same everywhere. It's going to really depend on what coast you're operating along and then the people that you're working with and how they will benefit or be disadvantaged by this operation. There is a huge movement right now to potentially use seaweed as a carbon sequestration mechanism, and there's a lot of energy going into studying that. Holly Froelich just published a really cool study that shows that there is potential for seaweed to actually sequester carbon, but the caveat is that the seaweed must then be exported to the deep ocean in the way that Tessa described for that to be effective, and it can only really be effective on small scales. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of potential for something like seaweed farming on a massive scale to offset global agriculture emissions. So we really have to think about what does a community want? How can we get there without not only negatively impacting that community, but then also negatively impacting the environment? And that also means how are we then going to truck that food that we are growing elsewhere? We have to also make sure that we reduce emissions there. And then the last part of that is thinking about the multiple stressors that we've been discussing throughout the course of this episode of your podcast, and how will all of that affect any given species? Because it's guaranteed that the location, the species, and the time of year and the people farming it are all going to impact the way that it responds to climate change and what that will mean for the people that end up consuming it.
Oh man, that really makes me want to talk about MPAs, but we do not have time to shove that into this.
I do think MPAs are part of the adaptive solution here, so we shouldn't leave them off the table.
There's a huge conversation we can go into about like what makes an effective MPA, how do you create a good MPA network, how do you enforce it, all sorts of stuff. Yep. That could be an entire another hour.
Yeah, you definitely don't want John Bruno to be part of that conversation.
I think I do.
No, you don't. You don't.
I think that's an invitation.
MPA debate. I would watch
they
that.
Are not a silver, they are not a silver bullet.
Well, I think you just gave me an idea for the next rendition of a live podcast recording, and you are definitely going to be invited.
I do think just on the solution set, I mean, to me, one of the real take-homes from this SROC report is the fact that we, the global populace, need to really, really up our ambition in terms of global carbon mitigation. You know, the UNFCCC, the Paris Agreement has set a 2-degree target with ambition for a 1.5-degree target. I think the SROC report makes pretty clear that 2 degrees is going to have catastrophic effects for a large part of the ocean, and we've got to get to a 1.5-degree future. You know, corals stand a fighting chance there. They don't at all at 2 degrees. There is a broader need for how do we bring the ocean community of average citizens, of scientists, of NGOs, of industries together to really kind of bring that voice, that ocean voice, toward greater global ambition around carbon mitigation.
So that actually leads me to one thing that I wanted to really do in this conversation, because Tessa is on the call. Through Twitter, you actually posted this question that I thought was really, really interesting, and I really wanted to ask it of the panel. You apparently had a conversation and asked, what are we doing for the ocean now that we didn't do 10 years ago? How are our actions matching the urgency of this time? So that's kind of where I want people's final thoughts.
Yeah, I'll just clarify that when I actually said that, I was sitting in a room that had many different people playing different roles in it. And so it was a meeting focused on conservation and resource management, but there were not very many scientists in the room, actually. It was a lot of other people who represent different roles in resource management in the ocean. But I think it's actually a really good question to be asking the scientific community as well. I mean, earlier in this discussion, George said, you know, this is an all hands on deck moment. I think it was George who said that, and I totally agree. And I guess I think it's a really reasonable question to ask, you know, what are we doing right now that actually matches the urgency that is conveyed in this report?
Who wants to take that?
Well, I mean, I don't think we're not doing anything in the ocean or at the planetary level, I think, yet, that is consistent with what the science is telling us about the scale and the scope of the problem. That being said, I do think that from an ocean perspective, where we're at now that we weren't 10 years ago, is we're actually talking about the ocean. We're actually thinking about the role of the ocean, both as a victim, but also as a solution to climate change in a way that we weren't a decade ago. And if you look at this SROC report, this is the first dedicated report after something like 25 years of work by the IPCC that focuses specifically on the ocean and the cryosphere. And so, you know, that's not necessarily going to solve this problem, but I think global awareness of the role of the ocean in terms of all of our well-being, not just people who fish from the ocean or live on the coast, but literally everybody around the globe, is a good sign.
Priya, I'd love to throw it over to you if you got some thoughts.
What resonated with me with that question was the fact that right now we're dealing with an election and all of these candidates have released these various climate plans, and you're seeing the ocean represented in its own section. And while as an ocean scientist, I feel like there's a lot to be desired from those sections and a lot more discussion that could happen, the fact that there is now a venue to have that discussion is really empowering. And the fact that the Green New Deal didn't include the ocean, and so now there are discussions of a teal deal, that's very exciting to me. And so I think that we're seeing these sorts of conversations beginning to happen on these bigger stages is really energizing.
John, what about yourself?
I think the fact that this report on the oceans came out in part reflects
the rapid increase in the science of climate change in the oceans. Again, going back to George and my days, like, it was shameful to do applied ecology back then. You know, we studied things like barnacle feeding rates and plant competition. And even 15 years ago, not a lot of us were really leaning on ocean conservation or the impacts of climate change. And now that's all everybody's doing. So there's been a big cultural shift in science generally, and I think particularly in ocean science, to really focus on this problem, documenting change, projecting future change, and kind of coming up with and testing solutions. That's certainly heartening.
If I can add one more thing about the SROC that I found really empowering was that the SROC acknowledged that there are different ways of knowing and different ways of gathering and knowledge. And so there was an effort to include perspectives from Indigenous communities and Native peoples to basically document what changes they've seen and integrate that into the report. And I think those sorts of perspectives have been lacking in the past and are totally improving the way that we're having these conversations now.
I think we should do a big thank you to all of the panelists for joining us today. I think that I definitely started this podcast on Team No Hope, but I'm really glad how we ended here. There's a lot of different paths people can take. So I think I might be going back on Team Hope after this. Yeah, thanks for coming and thanks for showing up and a great discussion.
Yes, yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
No, Team Hope all the way.
Yeah. Team Courage. Yeah. I don't know. Don't get too carried away there.
Well, you got to have hope. I also want to take this opportunity to thank you, our listeners. I want to recommend that our listeners follow along with each of the panelists on Twitter for the latest news on their work, and we will provide their handles in the description below.
And don't forget to subscribe to Ocean Science Radio. Leave us feedback, give us stars, and share the podcast with all your friends and enemies, whoever you want, everybody.
Share it with everybody. Until next time, this has been Ocean Science Radio.
I really
guess that's the end, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.